They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
You go right ahead and spell inflation your way if you like. The Federal Reserve spells it P-C-E. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the very last day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This week, to be honest, is kind of back-end heavy on economic news, chock full of all the inflation and employment and wage data that a certain group of people who meet regularly around a giant conference table in a big marble building on Constitution Avenue in Washington, D.C., just can't resist. I'm talking about the Fed here. You knew that, right? Anyway, today it was something called Personal Consumption Expenditures. PCE is the abbreviation, the Fed's preferred measure of inflation for all of those people sitting around that conference table. And in February, PCE was up 6.4% from a year ago. So keep that in your back pocket. Tomorrow morning, we get the March unemployment report, as part of which we will get, yes, of course, jobs data, but also wages. Last month, average hourly earnings were up 5.1%. The challenge here, of course, is that as high as wage inflation might be, and it is still not beating out price inflation. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains the consequences.
When prices shoot up, folks get grumpy if their wages don't keep up because their paychecks are losing ground.
That means that real incomes, inflation-adjusted incomes, what we call purchasing power, is being squeezed.
That's Gary Schlossberg at the Wells Fargo Investment Institute. And there's a paradox here, because while wage gains strong enough to keep up with price inflation would be good for pretty much everyone in the economy, that would actually be bad for the economy itself, because it would drive even more inflation. Here's Andrew Hunter at Capital Economics.
A wage price spiral obviously would be a huge concern for the Fed.
A situation where workers' demands and expectations for wage hikes actually drive employers to raise prices. Hunter says some factors driving wages now are moderating, like small business demand for workers and job openings.
Labor shortages tentatively starting to ease a little bit, consistent with wage growth stabilizing over the next few months.
The last time the economy fell into a damaging wage price spiral was the 1970s and 80s. But nowadays, workers' leverage to demand pay hikes and sap economic growth is small, says Gary Schlossberg.
Stagflation was really more of a chronic problem in the 1970s due to strength in unions, cost of living agreements that were built into contracts, really chasing inflation higher.
What we have now is a pandemic-induced shortage of workers to meet soaring consumer demand, which has led to some robust wage hikes. And Claudia Somm at the Jane Family Institute says,
it is very rare for employers to cut wages. Some prices can fall. I fully expect used car vehicles to not be as expensive next year as they are right now.
Meaning, in time, workers' purchasing power should gain back some of the ground that's been lost to soaring prices. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, tell you what, check the calendar before you despair over what I'm guessing might be the Wawas when we get there. End of the month, also end of the quarter, think portfolio rebalancing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, a little bit more now on this morning's reading on PCE, specifically goods, stuff. We actually spent nearly $60 billion less on goods in February than we did in January, which in normal times might not be great.
But right now it's good news because goods spending has been way above trend.
Wendy Edelberg's the director of the Hamilton Project. She's also a senior fellow in economic studies at Brookings.
We have been gorging on durable goods, at least consumers have been.
Think about how we were buying stuff like refrigerators and washing machines, also cars back in the early days of the pandemic. Those are durable goods. And maybe we're finally not gorging on them.
We have been hoping that as demand pivots away from goods, we would see some of the pressure in this sector start to go away and softer price numbers as a result.
And softer prices we saw. Durable goods inflation last month, 0%.
I don't want to make too much of 1 month. Monthly numbers can be obviously quite noisy, but it is good news that durable goods prices basically moved sideways in February.
Wendy Edelberg at Brookings helping us out there. One place where prices did not move sideways, services. We spent almost $94 billion more on services in February than we did in January. But after years, literally years, of subpar spending in that sector, how do the businesses selling those services, think restaurants and hairdressers, right, for just two examples, how do they decide what their pricing ought to be because they've got their own rising costs right now to deal with, right? Marketplace's Savannah Marr reports on the services pricing dilemma.
The Crowbar and Grill in Laramie, Wyoming, sells a lot of pizza and burgers, two things that have gotten a lot more expensive to make.
Beef prices are higher. Cheese has essentially doubled.
Manager Emily Madden says the restaurant has also increased wages to attract workers. To keep pace with those expenses,
we've had to raise prices about 20% in the last 2 years.
With the most recent increase this month, a basic burger with fries now goes for $14. So far, Madden says customers are taking it in stride, but she says it's a balancing act.
You know, not pricing people out of coming in, but also making sure that we can continue to pay our employees a decent wage and make sure our margins are where they should be.
Now is actually a pretty good time for businesses to adjust prices, says Shantanu Dutta, a professor of marketing at the University of Southern California. Customers know what businesses are up against.
It's in the air that costs are going up, wages going up, everything is in short supply.
And Dutta says there's something extra working in the service sector's favor.
Folks have been cooped up at home all this time, and you want to treat yourself. So I think that pent-up demand is showing itself.
That's true for Betty's Bath and Day Spa in Albuquerque.
It's amazing. We're double what our clientele levels typically were prior to the pandemic.
Owner Lisa McCullough says the spa just had an expensive remodel and supply prices have gone up.
You know, our massage oil, our lotion, our cleaning costs.
But with massages and spa treatments booked weeks in advance, McCullough says she's been able to keep prices stable. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
When we talk about inflation, be it PCE like today or the Consumer Price Index, which comes out again in a couple of weeks, we usually try to talk core, which strips out food and energy. Thing is, if food is your business, stripping out those costs doesn't work. At, for instance, a business like Grist and Toll, that's an independent and not very big at all flour mill tucked into a strip mall right in Pasadena, California.
So now I'm going to turn the mill on.
All right.
So you can't see it, but you can probably feel that vibration here of the runner.
Oh, yeah, a little bit. Yep. Oh, and here it comes. Look at that. Little flour stuff coming out.
Nan Kohler is the owner, also the miller of Grist and Toll. And that sound you just heard is from a visit I made back in 2017, which was, of course, before the great bread boom of 2020, the supply chain troubles of 21, and the soaring wheat prices of the war in Ukraine of 22. So we figured it was time to get her on the phone and ask her how things are going.
Well, things have been, I can honestly say, a bit disruptive lately. Coming off of 2 years of COVID, now we're looking at market disruption due to the war in Ukraine. I've definitely had to keep my nose to the grindstone and use all those small business owner skills of adaptation and outside the box thinking.
I want to ask you about both parts of that. First of all, the pandemic. You did okay in the pandemic, didn't you?
I did. We did. But, you know, it's not that it was steady. It was kind of a boom with a little bit of a bust. And now we were beginning to even out again.
Okay. So to the present situation, help me understand how a war in Ukraine and a dilemma that everybody, right, agrees is going to be really bad for global food production and prices because of the centrality of that area of the world in grain. How does that trickle down to Arroyo Boulevard in Pasadena?
Well, Kai, in many of the issues are very parallel to what I experienced during COVID. What disrupts me on a smaller level are the smaller goods costs going up or being unavailable. So a lot of certain bag sizes. I had problems with receiving grain, getting my LTL freight deliveries. LTL means less than truckload, so I'm moving a few pallets at a time. Now it's skyrocketing gas prices, so the cost for smaller movement of goods has radically gone up due to that. I don't purchase my grain on the commodities market. I pay well above commodity pricing because I deal direct with smaller scale farmers, and they are not in that system by and large. So my direct product price, right, the wheat itself, is not volatile. It's all of the other components that revolve around that.
What are your margins like? I mean, how do you know, what kind of profit are you making?
So my margins are healthy and I'm profitable, obviously much more so when I'm selling direct to consumer, my retail sales.
Yeah.
So it's funny, Kai, that when you visited me, you were the first person to ask me out loud, Nan Kohler, is your business profitable? And no one had ever asked me that point blank before. It is. It's okay, because my answer was immediately yes, which is the truth. But the longer answer is not in the way that I originally imagined when I dreamt up this business, because I really thought that I would be primarily driven by bulk flour sales to the wholesale market. Turned out to be not the greatest idea, because the costs that go into producing this product are very real and they're very, very expensive.
Well, yeah.
So I had actually cut back on the wholesale dramatically just leading into COVID, and I was already poised to be moving into primarily retail business.
Well, timing is everything. But look, let me ask you this. If I swing by on my way home this afternoon to pick up a bag of your most basic, not fancy flour, how much is it going to cost me? And how do you stay in business when I imagine that is several multiples of the $2.50 I pay for a 5-pound bag of flour at Piggly Wiggly?
Yeah, well, you're going to pay about $8 to $9, and that would be a 2.5-pound bag. Hmm. And I stay in business because people are looking for a healthier product. And it is a radically different product than what we have available to us in the marketplace on the grocery store shelves.
Now that you've made it through the pandemic and you seem to be tolerating, although with some you know, caveats there, you seem to be tolerating the inflationary spike and the war. What's the biggest thing on your mind?
The biggest thing on my mind is all of the bigger picture issues. Our political and financial philosophies that back mass industrialized products are not what's going to guarantee us food security. We need radical change in policy and financing to support small to mid-sized farms to help build back missing infrastructure.
Are you hopeful, or are you, late on the line, are you realistic about the chances for any of that happening?
I think that I'm not seeing decisive, bold leadership from the government But I'll just say, if I can make a plea to all of the venture capitalists who listen to Marketplace, we really need food security to go way up to the top of that list over tech and over widgets. It's real, and we keep getting affected by it, maybe for different reasons in the marketplace. First COVID, now a war, but I'm not optimistic that those types of disruptions will go away anytime soon.
Nan Kohler is the owner and the miller, actually, at Grist and Toll. It is a flour mill right smack in the heart of downtown Pasadena, California. Nan, thanks a lot. I really appreciate you taking the time today.
A pleasure, Kai. Thank you.
Coming up.
It's harder for them to go to sleep earlier.
Yeah, not a problem here, I'll tell you what. First, though, let's do the numbers. Told you it was going to be the Wawas. That was a guess. I didn't actually know. Dow Industrials down 550 today, 1.5%, 34,678. The NASDAQ down 221, 1.5% there as well, 14,220. S&P 500 declined 72 points. Also, hey, look, 1.5%. 45 and 30. Overall, stocks had their worst quarter in a couple of years. Oil stocks fell after news the U.S. is going to release 1 million barrels a day from the strategic reserve. ExxonMobil down 1.4%. Baker Hughes down 2.5%. Bond prices were up. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.32%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You might have heard this phrase in the news a time or two the past couple of months, gender-affirming care. The context, of course, is that conservative politicians in more than a handful of states have been trying to make it harder for transgender children to get medical interventions that affirm their gender identities, specifically medications that delay puberty for younger kids and hormone therapy for older teens. Treatments that are supported, by the way, by the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Medical Association, and some other major healthcare groups. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has ordered that state to investigate as child abuse anybody providing those treatments. The court has temporarily blocked those investigations, but a lot of families still face a difficult and expensive choice. Stay in Texas or leave, as Marketplace's Amy Scott tells us.
The moment Kay knew her family had to leave Texas, she was driving with her 10-year-old daughter.
And you know, she was in the back seat behind me. And so we were going from acting class to go get a donut, to go get a treat.
Kay's daughter, we'll call her O, is transgender. We're using initials to protect the family's privacy. Some friends were planning to protest the governor's order, and Kay asked her daughter if she'd feel comfortable saying a few words about being a trans kid. But first, Kay had to explain what the order meant, that O's parents, teachers, and doctors could get in trouble for helping her live as a girl.
And she got really quiet, and I went, well, do you have any questions? And then she asked, am I going to die?
Kay was still driving and couldn't see her daughter's face. She pulled over, threw the car into park, and jumped out.
But I opened her door and I just said, no, oh my gosh, no, you're not going to die. Why would you ask me that? And she said, I mean, without a beat, you know, because everybody hates me. And that was when I just knew, like, I can't do this.
Kay and her husband are lifelong Texans. they'd talked before about whether to leave as the state's Republican-controlled legislature proposed bill after bill targeting transgender youth. All but one of them, restricting trans kids' access to sports, failed. Now, the fear that Child Protective Services might come knocking on their door was too much to bear.
I just said, I don't want to go into some small room for my supervised visit with my children where I explain we could have left, but we were too late.
So they're putting their house on the market and moving to Portland, Oregon. I talked with several families facing similar decisions. They've been sharing maps, identifying states with strong LGBTQ protections, including California, Colorado, and much of the Northeast. Some have already left. Camille Ray moved from the Austin area to Potomac, Maryland, outside D.C. last August. With her three children, her father, and a Mexican hairless Chihuahua mix named Ivan. Camille had been active in the fight against anti-trans legislation in Texas, and one day her transgender son, Leon, asked to come with her when she testified at the Capitol.
He ended up having to hear some very hateful and difficult things for a child to hear, and so he ended up getting chronic stomach aches and missing a lot of school and almost failing second grade.
Now, she says, 9-year-old Leon is doing much better. He can just be a kid.
The schools are accepting and supportive of Leon. Everyone that I talk to, they've all been supportive, you know, from the guy at the UPS store to Leon's teacher to whoever, you know, I end up telling the story.
The move has taken a financial toll. Camille is a science writer and was able to find a new job. But Leon's father has to commute back to Austin for a week every month. And they had to tap the kids' college savings.
Basically, it costs us upwards of $20,000 to move here. And on top of that, our mortgage almost doubled.
The exodus has been hard on those who remain in Texas and the trans adults who've been fighting alongside these families. Remington Johnson is a Presbyterian minister and soon-to-be ICU nurse in Austin.
I firmly expect that most of the community of parents that I'm connected with will be gone 12 months from now. And it feels really bad. It makes me feel less safe.
But she understands why they're leaving. Not everyone can afford to leave or has the job flexibility. Ed in San Antonio shares custody of his transgender daughter with his ex-wife. So there are two households involved. He and his current wife both own businesses.
I've been in business for 20 years in Texas, and I'm a native Texan, so it's pretty devastating to, like, think about having to just kind of up and leave.
For these families, not affirming their children's gender identities is unthinkable. They've listened to their kids, done tons of research, and consulted mental health and medical experts. Like many parents of transgender children, Ed saw a cloud lift when his daughter could just be herself.
That's like a joy of parenting, like knowing that you're getting it right. Because, you know, she's so much happier and doing better in school and, you know what I mean? There's no question.
The question is whether he'll be able to keep supporting her in Texas. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Been around teenagers long about wake-up time for high school, you know morning is just not their peak performance time of the day. Be that as it may, though, more than 80% of public high schools in this country have their first bell before 8:30 in the morning. That's according to the National Center for Education Statistics. For years now, scientists have been pushing for later start times, and in some districts, change has begun or is coming this fall. Philadelphia announced this month that high schools there are going to push their start time to 9 a.m. Here in California, a state law taking effect next school year says schools can't start earlier than 8:30. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on the historical and the economic reckonings that go into that change.
It's really dark when Mara Williams' two teenagers leave their home in eastern Pennsylvania each morning. So dark that she got them headlamps for their walk to the bus stop.
They're like little miners, you know, they got a little lamp on their forehead.
Williams says the kids will only hold the headlamps, not wear them. They're too cool for that. They have to leave the house at 6:25 in order to be on time for their first classes at 7:30. And Williams says it's a struggle.
They are very tired almost all of the time.
Biologically, it's harder for them to go to sleep earlier.
Rhoda Oh is a professor at Boston University. She's one of the authors on a report on adolescent sleep patterns from the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Around the time of puberty, their internal clock, which is driven by their melatonin levels, right, shifts. And this shift is creating a delayed sort of sleep phase.
Oh says some schools rotate which classes are first in the day, so students won't be at their sleepiest for the same class. And she says the reason so many schools start early has to do with the way we used to work.
It comes back to when we were much more an agrarian community, right? We just have locked ourselves into this going to bed early to rise.
School systems still have to navigate parents' work schedules. In Niagara Falls in western New York, Superintendent Mark Laurie would love to push back the start time for high schoolers. But that means they'd get home later. And he says in his school district, where there's lots of single-parent households, that won't work.
Because so many of our high school kids are the caregivers for their elementary siblings.
Even if release times lined up, Laurie is dealing with a bus driver shortage, so there wouldn't be enough drivers to transport the high schoolers and the younger kids at the same time. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which, once again, correlation is not causation and context is everything. You no doubt saw the announcement from the White House. Maybe you heard me talk about it up in the numbers. The president's going to order the release of 1 million barrels of oil a day from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. That goes on for the next 180 days once it starts. You perhaps did not see that crude oil prices dropped about 6% today. Well, here's the context that gets to the correlation causation thing. 1 million barrels of oil a day, it's about 5% of all the oil we use in this country every day, about 1% of daily global demand. Russian exports of oil that are not hitting the world market anymore, about 3 million barrels a day. So it's a short-term fix, is what I'm saying. All right, we're going. Here's your moment of economic context. Saw this on Bloomberg. At a New York Fed conference today, a Stanford University political scientist presented some research that shows the average New York City office worker intends to reduce time in the office by 49%. I'm going to say that that's all right, you know? Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Petra, and Stephanie Seek. Or the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.